Now this election marks the first time voters will need to provide photo identification in a presidential general election. The measure has been seen as controversial, with lawsuits challenging the law, saying that it could potentially disenfranchise voters in the upcoming election.
While a judge ruled that the state could make its voter ID law more strict, it was ruled that the state could only do that if there was a safety net in place to make sure people would be able to get photo ID. But a new report from The Nation shows that there might still be some confusion at the state level about how to get a voter ID.
Patrick Marley joins us now with more on the story and on the late-breaking news that a federal judge has ordered an investigation into the DMV. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Well, I want to get to that latest news, the federal judge looking for an investigation into this seeming misinformation at the DMV around the photo IDs. But first, I want to talk about how we got there. Start us off with the story about what started this ball rolling.
Sure. So there's a group called Vote Riders. They oppose the voter ID law and work to assist people in getting IDs. So they give them information about how to get IDs. They set up cab rides for them, and sometimes they'll even accompany them. And in one case, they did accompany a voter named Zach Moore to the DMV station in Madison, and they audio recorded it. He was told by three different employees of the DMV wrong information about his ability to get an ID or temporary voting credentials. Vote Riders then gave this tape to The Nation. The Nation wrote a story about that. I then caught up with it and got a copy of the tape from Vote Riders. So these two stories were out yesterday. Then this morning, the judge overseeing the case said he'd read those stories and wants an investigation into what happened.
So in this case, was the DMV in question that may be giving out this bad information about photo IDs, was it just in Dane County, just in Madison, or elsewhere in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, this group says they have done recordings of 10 visits to the DMV and have gotten all kinds of different answers. Now, this is the only case where they went in with an actual voter who was presenting his documents. He didn't have a birth certificate, and it tells what happened to him. In the other cases, they went and they just asked hypothetically, you know, I have a friend or a relative who doesn't have a birth certificate and needs an ID. What would I need to do to get that for them? And the DMV employees apparently told them differing information based on locations. So really, all we really know about is this one case where wrong information was given out to one voter by three different employees. I think the supporters of the voter ID would say, well, that may be an anomaly. This is all we know is this one case. And the opponents of voter ID would say, you know, even one person being told wrong information is unacceptable, and it raises question about what's happening with all the other people out there around the state who are trying to get IDs.
Patrick, can you square us away on what you do need to get a photo ID for voting in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that most people probably already have something that they can use to vote, and others can get it relatively easily. The litigation has really boiled down now to those who have the most trouble getting IDs because they don't have a birth certificate, or they have an error on their birth certificate, or they might not have some other types of identity documents. But a driver's license works, a state-issued ID card works, a passport works. Those are the kinds of things that people need to bring to the polls.
Now, you mentioned the advocacy group Vote Riders, and we have a bit of audio here from the national coordinator, Molly McGrath, who said that the answers that were given about getting that ID were all over the board. That's a quote from her. Here's a recording of Molly McGrath interacting with DMV employees.
I'm just wondering how that would work. Like, for like, if you initiate the petition process, do you get an ID for voting?
No, you don't get anything right away.
You don't get anything.
Okay, so just so even if we start the petition process and it takes 8 weeks,
right.
He won't be able to vote.
Right. Well, I don't know. They're working on that, so it's kind of up in the air right now. So if you want more information, we can get you to the supervisor over there at window 3 while we do that.
Some audio there of what we're talking about. National coordinator of Vote Riders, Molly McGrath, interacting with DMV employees. You can hear that there's some confusion. There's more than one employee involved, which seems to run contrary to what was stated, that the DMV employees have been trained and were now up to speed and were ready to help the public on what they needed to get a voter ID, which did not include a birth certificate.
Right. So it's important to note that this happened on September 22nd, which is the very same day that the state DMV filed something in court before Judge Peterson that said, we've trained everybody, everybody at DMV knows what to do, and they know that if you go in there and you don't have a birth certificate, you will be told, fill out this simple form, and within 6 days you will get something that you can use to vote. And if when we're closer to the election, you will be overnight mailed something so that you will not at the DMV station, but within 24 hours get what you can use to vote. And as you heard from the audio there, this particular voter was told that, in fact, he could not get an ID and that there was not a guarantee as to how long it would take.
Patrick Marley stays with us right now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a new report that found that some Wisconsin DMV offices may be providing incorrect information to people trying to get a photo ID ahead of that November election for voting.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about a new report that found that some state DMV officials are providing incorrect and incomplete information to people seeking a photo ID in order to vote in November.
We're talking to Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And Patrick, we left off listening to some audio of exchanges between would-be voters looking for that ID and DMV employees. Do we have any idea how these DMV employees were, what kind of training they were supposed to have undergone at this point?
Well, the I haven't seen the exact details of the specific training that they got, but the what the Department of Justice has consistently told the judge is that they have updated all of their employees as to what the current protocols are. They have put up signs at DMV stations that say, no birth certificate, no problem, and that's a tagline they use in some of their other communications, both from the DMV and from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, to try to communicate to voters. One challenge for them as they do public outreach is that different people are in different scenarios, and they can't, in a 30-second spot, go into all the details of what you do. So they try to just tell people, you can get one easily, we can take care of you. So that's their tagline, is no birth certificate, no problem. But that's not what Zach Moore was told when he went in there without a birth certificate.
And what has Attorney General Brad Schimmel had to say about this and the state of preparedness of the DMV to handle this?
Well, really, he said very little. The only thing he said was that his court filing of September 22nd was accurate, meaning that when he told the judge that the DMV employees had been appropriately trained, that was true. We will hear more from him in a week. The Department of Justice, on behalf of the DMV, will have to file something on October 7th that says what they found when they looked into this particular case and what they've done to correct it.
And has the DMV itself said anything?
They've said very little. They've said that if something like this, they have not acknowledged that it happened, but said if something like that were to happen, that corrective action would be taken to get the workers the appropriate training.
And I want to talk now.
And they have said that kind of practice would violate their protocols and that their staff know what they're supposed to do.
Let's talk about the decision now from the federal judge to look for an investigation into this. And one thing that's notable is it sounds like the investigation is supposed to be completed by next Friday. Is that right?
That's right. He gave them a week. The other thing that's very unusual about it is that, you know, the judge did this on his own. He did not wait for the plaintiffs to raise this or file a motion and ask for an investigation. He just read the newspaper. He read the Nation magazine. And then within less than 24 hours, published this order telling the DMV they had to do this investigation.
And is this the same judge who was involved in the initial challenge?
Yes, he's still got jurisdiction over the case. He's the judge overseeing the ongoing litigation.
You know, based on past experience with the sallies on voter ID in court, do we have any idea what sort of information he might be looking for come next Friday?
Well, yes, he's going to want to know that this was an isolated incident, that it's not something that's happening more broadly, that the DMV truly does have a handle on this, and that voters are getting accurate information, that people in this very situation are able to quickly be able to get a way to vote so that people aren't disenfranchised. He's going to have grave concerns about that. He said that in his decision that found serious qualms with a number of voting laws in Wisconsin. That said, you know, the vote, he and other courts have upheld the voting ID law, and courts in general are very reluctant to make significant changes to voter laws right before an election out of fear that it leads to more voter confusion.
The weak timeline sounds like a bit of a scramble. Is this something that you think will just stay in Dane County, or do you think this will end up being an investigation that has to encompass the entire state in a week?
Oh, I mean, what he has asked them to investigate is this particular situation that we know about, the 10-minute audio of this one guy going in and trying to get an ID. So I think that's what the investigation will focus on. Clearly, the plaintiffs in the case will likely try to, you know, raise questions about whether that was unique or, in fact, a problem elsewhere. And I think it remains to be seen if somebody's going to turn up another tape or another voter is going to come forward and describe their experience. We'll just have to see.
And Patrick,
I think it's clear we'll have fights about this up until and probably well beyond November 8th when we have an election.
And Patrick, just very briefly, if the judge isn't satisfied with the findings, what happens next?
Well, he's got jurisdiction over the case. I mean, he could put the law on hold. I mean, he could do lots of things, whether he does or not. But, I mean, I think it is conceivable, I'm not saying it's likely, that he would make a significant change to the voter ID law, finding an easier path for people who have the most difficulty in getting IDs. You know, for a while, a different judge had put in place something where people could have just signed a statement at the polls. Does somebody try to make that a possibility again? It's possible.
Well, keep watching. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joined us with the latest news on voter ID in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. As temperatures start to cool down, there are few things as comforting as a slice of warm, home-baked bread.
Peter Reinhardt sees the act of baking bread as a transformational process. He'll be sharing the secrets of this process at Fermentation Fest, which starts this weekend in Reedsburg and runs through October 9th.
He joins us now on this Food Friday. He's an instructor at the International Baking and Pastry Institute at Johnson & Wales University, and he's the author of 10 books on baking, including The Bread Baker's Apprentice, the 15th anniversary edition. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, in a recent blog post, you share your thoughts on transformation. You actually think that bread baking is transformational. That's a pretty expansive word to use for something like bread baking. What's the case that bread baking is all that?
Well, I think it starts with my definition of transformation is a radical change from one thing into something else. And I think that if you look at the history of bread and the way bread has been used in culture, in religion, in society, as a symbol of so many things, including a symbol of life and essentially a symbol of humankind, you have to ask yourself, well, why? What is it about bread that allows it to become this powerful symbol and this universal symbol in every religion and every culture? And I started working it backwards and said, okay, you know, why is this? And I realized that the very process, the 12 stages that it takes for bread, for wheat to become bread, requires a series of transformations from one thing, wheat growing in the field, to flour, which is the wheat that's been destroyed and made into powder, to another transformation into dough, which is brought back to life, and a final transformation of dough into bread, in which all of these ingredients kind of come together and make something so radically different than what it started out to be that if you think about it, it's a perfect symbol of transformation. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's a symbol of the journey of our own lives.
And in that same post, you said, hey, we're going through some troublesome times now, a lot of bad news out there, a tough political election, but maybe by making bread, baking bread, breaking bread together, we could transform our society maybe into something a little better.
Well, of course, we all can do the little things that are in front of us, the opportunities, the faces. But I think that historically, life's been hard and rough, you know, forever, and people struggle and suffer. But one of the things that life has given us is the opportunity to celebrate it. And I think throughout the year, there are festivals, there are events that allow us to put aside the troubles that we face and celebrate this deeper thing that each of us believes in our core, and that is that ultimately life is good, God is good, and we want to be able to celebrate that, even though life is also very hard. And we're right at the beginning today yesterday was the official Harvest Festival in the Judeo-Christian tradition called Michaelmas, which is the celebration of the harvest. And tomorrow the Firmfest kicks off, which is another celebration. And I basically said, let's take this opportunity to once again celebrate the things and affirm the things that we know to be true, that are deeper than the troubles and problems that we face on a daily basis.
I started bread baking after a long time last winter because it was dark and it was gloomy, and every day for a month before Downton Abbey, I would bake a loaf of bread. And it was pretty amazing. I felt really good. Do you think there is something about getting over that hurdle of thinking that this is this really hard thing and discovering when people try it that it does have this sort of comforting, sort of feel-good factor?
Yeah, I think there is the participation in any process, whether it's bread making, woodworking, carpentry, any kind of a craft, so to speak. There is a joy that comes from just participating in it and turning one thing into something else. And bread baking is one of the easier crafts that people can participate. Everybody can do it, and it's not that hard. Some people are intimidated by yeast, but it doesn't take long to get them over that. And I think that one of the reasons why bread books have become so popular in the last 10, 15 years is because they serve as guidebooks to help people overcome some of those fears and concerns. And for those who deeply get into it as a hobby or as some kind of a family practice, they find that every time they do it, it gives them joy. I've even heard that real estate agents believe that the smell of freshly baked bread in the oven can be an inducement. If you put your house up for sale and you walk somebody through it, you've got a better chance of closing the deal.
We're talking to Peter Reinhardt on this Food Friday, author of The Bread Baker's Apprentice. He's coming to Fermentation Fest in the Reedsburg area. He's inspiring us to bake bread, and not just bread, Peter. You say maybe someone like me, I am in that camp that's a little intimidated by bread baking. If I take it in stages, I can not just make bread at home. I can make really good bread. What is it? What are the steps to going from, you know, those first breads, the experiments that might go wrong, to making fantastic bread at home?
In the last few years, there's been an awakening in America to the possibilities of how good bread really can be. Many people thought you had to go all the way to Europe, to France, or to Germany to get good bread. And that was true to a certain extent. We had average bread here. But all of a sudden, people have learned some of these techniques. And so the home bakers want to know, okay, how can I make a loaf of bread in my home oven that's comparable to some of the breads that I'm getting from these new artisan bakeries? And it turns out that the same techniques that are available to the artisan bakers are available to home bakers. It's just understanding the relationship of time and temperature and the ingredients themselves and learning how to work with them. So one of the tricks that has probably raised the dial on everybody's baking at home is understanding that longer, slower fermentation generally produces a better tasting loaf of bread. And the old cookbooks that we had back in the 50s and 60s were all about making bread fast, getting something done, mix it, let it rise for an hour, shape it, let it rise and bake it. And it makes okay bread. And if you add sugar and butter to it, of course, it makes it taste fine. But if you want to try to make a great baguette or a ciabatta or one of these breads that are becoming so popular today, where the main ingredient is flour, it's all about the wheat, then how do you get and coax the full flavor, the potential of flavor that's trapped in that wheat? How do you bring it out? And that's where the artisan techniques come in. And there, it turns out that everybody can do them and everybody is doing them. We've got this growing movement of home bakers. And I'd say most of the people that buy these bread books are home bakers, not professional bakers, because they want to be able to do the same thing that the professionals do.
And Peter, where do we start if we want to learn some of those artisan tools and do what the great bread bakers do? What's the first starting block for us?
One thing that people can do if they have access to it is to go to some classes that may be taught at a local cooking school. Some of the cooking stores even have cooking classes. There's a lot of great instructional videos available. I did a video course with a group called Craftsy, craftsy.com, that I've done three videos with them and their classes. They cost actually less than a cookbook, and you can stream the instructional videos into your home, so it's like having a teacher right there. And I've got, for instance, my artisan bread course has over 25,000 people have signed up for that. I even did a pizza course, which is offered for free through Craftsy, and we have about 800,000 people have signed up for that, and they're making pizza. So we, you know, that's one way. But I think the simplest way is to find a bread book that you like. There's many great ones out there. I've written a number, but there's certainly other authors that have done good bread books. And find a recipe, a bread that you want to make, and start with one bread. And if you can master one bread, then you could pretty much master them all over time. But start with one, do it at least three times, because by the third time, you'll have figured out all the tweaks that you need to make, how your oven works, whether it's a little high, a little low, what, you know, how to find the right color, how to know when it's done. And all these, it's a very fast learning curve. It really starts there.
You've shared a really cool sounding recipe for bread called struwen, I think it's pronounced. Can you tell us about this struwen bread?
Yes, that's my all-time favorite bread, and I think I've written about it in at least half of the books that I've done. Struwen is a bread that's associated with Michaelmas, this harvest festival that we were discussing earlier. It actually was a bread, the celebratory bread done by the people of Western Scotland back in the 16, 17, 1800s. I think it pretty much it fell off the map around the 19th, 20th century as the farming communities were sort of subsumed by the cities. But it really was a bread about the harvest. In my version, and there was no recipe, I had to kind of create my own after reading about this bread in folklore, meant all the grains or whatever was ready to be harvested on September 28th, the eve of the feast, would be gathered by the men and their sons, and they'd be brought home where the women and daughters would stay up all night making loaves of bread. They had all the pressure on them because the thought was that if your bread fell, then you would have a year of bad luck. So the women had a lot more pressure on them than the men, as usual. And then in the morning, the freshly baked loaves would be brought to an early morning mass where the priest would bless them and consecrate them to loved ones who had passed away in the previous year. And then there would be a procession through the town, and the loaves would be given to the poor. And it was that sort of ritual and celebratory pattern that they have that's what grabbed my attention. And since there was no existing recipe anywhere, I just started from the spirit of the thing, a harvest bread. And over a number of years, I kept working on it and working on it till I found one that kind of the right combination of ingredients. And there's about 12 ingredients in my version. I used to make it in the bakery that my wife and I had in California. And after we sold the bakery, the people that bought it continued to make that bread. That particular bread was the most popular bread we made. Probably makes the best toast of any bread I've ever tasted. I think it's the perfect toasting bread, which is perfect for the sort of a new emergence of toast cafes that are happening all over the United States. So it's, believe it or not, it's coming back, even though we're many years away from having that bakery. And the recipe's been out there for a long time. I just read that La Brea Breads, which is one of the largest producers of artisan breads in the United States, is bringing out their own version of struwen. And I don't know when it's going to hit the shelves and where you can get it, but it's coming out because I read about it on their website. And they even told a little bit of the story about this idea of harvesting the grains.
That sounds amazing, Peter. I want to ask you just briefly as we wrap up. Well, first of all, I want to say that recipe is available on the Central Time Facebook page. But what does it taste like?
It's slightly sweet because we add a little honey and a little bit of brown sugar to it, and it's moist in the center. And the reason it makes such good toast is that if you slice a nice thick piece, maybe about a half to two-thirds of an inch thick, and make toast out of it, the outside gets this wonderful caramelization that you expect from good toast, but the inside stays very moist. One of the secret ingredients in the dough is some cooked brown rice, a small amount of cooked grain that helps to hold the moisture in. So you get this great contrast of of crackly, almost toffee-like surface and a very creamy, almost custard-like center. Those combinations in your mouth, you put a little fresh butter on that, some local jam, and you've got yourself a full meal. And believe it or not, my wife and I existed on two pieces of Struan toast every morning and a glass of orange juice while we had our cafe. And that was how we started the day. And I think that's one of the reasons why this particular bread has such deep meaning for me. I feel connected to this bread in a way that I don't feel about any other bread. It's if I say if bread is a metaphor of life, then I'd say this bread is the metaphor of me.
Well, you really sold me. I'm going to try it. And it's up on the Central Time Facebook page. It sounds delicious. Peter, thank you so much for joining us and talking today.
It's a pleasure being with you. And I can't wait to get to Firmfest and see everybody.
Great. Well, that was Peter Reinhardt, a baker and educator. He's also the author of The Bread Baker's Apprentice. Its 15th anniversary edition was just published.
And as you just mentioned, he will be at Fermentation Fest. That starts this weekend in Reedsburg, runs through October 9th. Get more info and find the schedule at fermentationfest.com.